the moment the first baggage detachments of our army were seen by the enemy, who were lurking hidden in the woods, they suddenly dashed forth in full force, having already in the woods ordered their line in regular ranks and encouraged one another for the conflict, and so charged down upon our cavalry. Our cavalry were easily beaten and thrown into disorder, and with incredible speed the enemy rushed down to the river, so that almost at the same moment they were seen at the edge of the woods, in the river, and then at close quarters. I had everything to do at one moment. The flag to raise, a signal of a general call to arms, the trumpet call to sound, the troops to recall from entrenching, the men to bring in who had gone somewhat farther afield, the line to form, the troops to harangue, the signal to give. A great part of these duties was prevented by the shortness of time and the advance of the enemy. I gave the necessary commands, and then ran down in a chance direction to harangue the troops, and came to the 10th Legion. My harangue to the troops was no more than a charge to bear in mind their ancient valour, to be free from alarm, and bravely to withstand the onslaught of the enemy. Then, as the enemy were no further off than the range of a missile, I gave the signal to engage. I started off in the other direction to give the same harangue, but found them already fighting. The men of the 12th Legion, with their standards collected in one place, were so closely packed in that they hampered each other for fighting. All the centurions of the 4th cohort had been slain, and the standard bearer likewise, and the standard was lost. The condition of affairs, as I saw, was critical indeed, and there was no support that could be sent up. Taking therefore a shield from a soldier of the rearmost ranks, as I myself was coming thither without a shield, I went forward into the first line, and calling on the centurions by name and cheering on the rank and file, I bade them advance and extend the companies, that they might ply swords more easily. My coming brought hope to the troops and renewed their spirit, each man of his own accord, in sight of their commander-in-chief, desperate as his own cause might be, was fain to do his utmost. So the onslaught of the enemy was checked a little. I instructed the tribunes to close the legions gradually together, and then to advance against the enemy. This was done, and as one soldier supported another, and they did not fear that their rear would be surrounded by the enemy, they began to resist more boldly and to fight more bravely. Meanwhile, the soldiers of the two legions which had acted as baggage guard at the rear of the column heard news of the action. Pressing on with all speed, they became visible to the enemy on the crest of the hill. Their arrival wrought a great change in the situation. Even such of our troops as had fallen under stress of wounds propped themselves against their shields and renewed the fight. Then the sutlers, seeing the panic of the enemy, met their armed assault even without arms. Finally, the cavalry, to obliterate by valour the disgrace of their flight, fought at every point in the effort to surpass the legionaries. The enemy, however, even when their hope of safety was at an end, displayed a prodigious courage. When their front ranks had fallen, the next stood on the prostrate forms and fought from them. When these were cast down and the corpses were piled up in heaps, the soldiers, standing as if it were upon a mound, hurled darts on our troops or caught and returned our pikes. Not without reason, therefore, was it to be concluded that these were men of great courage, who had dared to cross a very broad river, to climb very high banks, and to press up over most unfavourable ground. These were tasks of the utmost difficulty, but greatness of courage had made them easy. But finally, the engagement brought the name and nation of the Nervii almost to utter destruction. I and my knights had decided to go and attack some Turks who were loading their baggage in their camp on our left. So we fell on them. As we were pursuing them through the camp, I caught sight of a Saracen on the point of mounting his horse. One of his knights was holding the bridle. At the moment he had both of his hands on the saddle to pull himself up, I gave him a thrust with my lance just under the armpit and struck him dead. On seeing this, his knight left his lord and the horse, and thrusting his lance at me as I passed, caught me between the shoulders, pinning me down to the neck of my horse in such a way that I couldn't draw the sword at my belt. I therefore had to draw the sword attached to my horse. When he saw me with my sword drawn, he withdrew his lance and left. As I was coming back, the Turks thrust at me with their lances. Under the weight of their attack, my horse was brought to its knees, and I went flying forward over its ears. I got up as soon as I could, with my shield at my neck and sword in hand. One of my knights, named Erard de Sivery, may God grant him grace, came to me and advised our drawing back towards a ruined house where we could wait for the king, who was on his way. But as we were going there, some on foot and some on horseback, a great body of Turks came rushing at us, bearing me to the ground and riding over my body so that my shield went flying from my neck. As soon as they had passed, Erard de Sivery came back to me and took me with him to the walls of the house. While we were there, the Turks attacked us from all sides. Some of them got into the house and pricked us with their lances from above. My knights asked me to hold onto their horses' bridles, which I did, for fear the beasts should run away. Then they put up a vigorous defense against the Turks. During this incident, Hugh de Cotte received 3 wounds in the face from a lance, and so did Raoul de Wanou, while Frederick de Lupe had a lance thrust between his shoulders, which made so large a wound that the blood poured from his body as if from the bunghole of a barrel. A blow from one of the enemy's swords landed in the middle of Erard de Sivery's face, cutting through his nose so that it was left dangling over his lips. Just as I had uttered a prayer, he said to me, "My lord, if you think that neither I nor my heirs will incur reproach for it, I will go and fetch you help from the Comte d'Anjou, whom I see in the fields over there." I said to him, "My dear man, it seems to me that you would win great honor for yourself if you went for help to save our lives. Your own, by the way, is also in great danger." I spoke truly, for he died of his wound. As I stood there on foot with my knights, wounded as I have told you, King Louis came up at the head of his battalion with a great sound of shouting, trumpets and kettle drums. He halted with his troops on a raised causeway. Never have I seen a finer or more handsome knight. He seemed to tower head and shoulders above all his people. On his head was a gilded helmet, and a sword of German steel was in his hand. The moment he stopped, those good knights in his division whom I have already named to you, together with other valiant knights of his, flung themselves right at the Turks. It was, I can assure you, a truly noble passage of arms, for no one there drew either bow or crossbow. It was a battle of maces against swords between the Turks and our people, with both sides inextricably entangled. Looking at it, the city of Yunnan Fu appeared strong and impregnable. The field marshal withdrew the troops and retreated to a distance of 7 li from the city. We set up our encampment along the mountainside and received orders to make ramparts and moats during the night. I, at the head of the regiment's soldiers, worked overnight, erecting ramparts and digging moats. The first squadron advanced to cut off the tail of the bandits and to seek an opening towards the city. But when our green standard troops charged the enemy, the roaring sound of cannons and muskets was incessant and lasted for such a long time that the ears became used to it. Half of the rebels vacillated and fled, but the other half, comprising several squadrons, did not budge and were resolved to fight to the death. Councillor Hefei called aloud and ordered, "Crush those rebel detachments that have not been routed and are still in control of the bridge and the village." Our 2 banners, yelling, went to the assault, but the enemy's fire of cannons, fiery arrows, and the volleys of muskets were overwhelming. Protecting themselves in hidden spots among the ruined walls, our 2 banners became all mingled into 1 group. I reached the bank of the river by myself and saw that our soldiers were being continuously wounded. Hefei sent a man with the order to advance on foot, and as soon as we got within shooting range, the rear guard of the rebels was in disarray. I immediately grabbed the flag and crossed the river, pressing forward in pursuit of the rebels' rearguard. The rebels fled. As soon as I caught up with them, I told them that they must all surrender. They all knelt down, laid down their weapons, and begged me to spare their lives. Then, when a Bayara guard shot a rebel with an arrow, they all stood up and fled. 2 rebels got hold of long swords that had been abandoned, and, indifferent to death, came forward slashing at us. Rushing off, I whipped the horse and climbed on top of the high riverbank. Looking behind me, I saw that armored soldier Dengse could not climb onto the bank. 1 rebel caught up with him and hacked at him. Because Dengse was scared, he ducked, turned his body on 1 side, so the rebel hit the quiver and the horse. As Dengse fell off the horse, I shot the rebel and made him fall down. Who killed the other rebel, I do not know. I looked to make sure that Dengsei had not been harmed, then quickly got hold of my flag, and pushing and killing, reached the base of the city wall. One could see that the rebels at the base of the wall were ready for battle. Thickly lined up in a two-echelon formation, they were also firing cannons from the top of the wall. As our soldiers heard the bugle signal for the withdrawal of the troops, they immediately turned back altogether. Then we interrogated captured rebels. On the 12th, the Emperor in person arrived from Beijing at the head of the chief ministers. In a wide open space, he pitched the palatial square tent and greeted the field marshal, high officials, officers, and soldiers. He lined up the flags and prostrated in front of the flags at the sound of the conch. Thereupon, he ordered generals and soldiers to present themselves kneeling down in front of him and offered them tea. Everyone prostrated in front of His Imperial Grace. I went to Lugao Bridge and, kneeling down, met my father. I heard about the matter concerning my fourth brother. Then, weeping, I went through the gardens, entered the city, and still weeping, entered my house. I prostrated as I met my mother and the others. When I met my children and younger brothers, I could not recognize them. Looking at them, the houses and heated beds of the capital appeared even more odd, and suddenly it was like a confused, hazy dream. The more I thought about it, the more I marveled at what seemed like being born again. Is this a dream, or is it not? As our small and way-worn party came to a halt before the walls of the convent, the men from these different regiments came swarming out to greet us, loudly cheering us as they rushed up and seized our hands. The difference in appearance between ourselves and these newcomers was, indeed, just then, very great. They looked fresh, from good quarters and good rations. Their clothes and accoutrements were comparatively new and clean, and their cheeks ruddy with the glow of health and strength, whilst our men, on the contrary, were gaunt-looking, way-worn and ragged, our faces burnt almost to the hue of an Asiatic's by the sun, our accoutrements rent and torn, and many without even shoes to their feet. However, we had some work in us yet, and perhaps were in better condition for it than our more fresh-looking comrades. War is a sad blunter of the feelings of men. We felt eager to be at it again. Nay, I'm afraid we longed for blood as the cheer of our comrades sounded in our ears. And yet, amidst all this, softer feelings occasionally filled the breasts of these gallant fellows, even whilst they were thirsting for a sight of the enemy. Some of the men near me suddenly recollected as they saw the snow lying thickly in our path that this was Christmas Eve. The recollection soon spread amongst the men, and many talked of home and scenes upon that night in other days in old England, shedding tears as they spoke of their relatives and friends, never to be seen by them again. As the night approached, we became less talkative, when suddenly a shout arose in front that the French were upon us. In an instant, every man was on the alert, and we were rushing forwards in extended order to oppose them. It proved a false alarm. Thus, we staggered on, night and day, for about 4 days, before we discovered the reason of this continued forced march. The discovery was made by a good-tempered, jolly fellow named Patrick McLaughlin. He inquired of an officer marching directly in his front the destination intended. "By Jesus, Muster Hills," I heard him say. "Where the dickens is it you're taking us to?" "To England, McLaughlin," returned the officer, with a melancholy smile on his face. "If we can get there." This McLaughlin was a good specimen of a thorough Irish soldier. Nothing could disturb his good humour and high spirits. He'd ever some piece of Irish humour upon his tongue's end whilst he staggered under the weight of his pack. He would, in all probability, have been amongst the first who did reach England. But during the march, he was attacked with the racking pains of acute rheumatism and frequently fell to the ground, screaming with agony. On such occasions, his companions would do that for him which they admitted to perform towards others, whilst the men could scarcely refrain from laughter at the extraordinary things he gave utterance to when racked with pain and staggering with fatigue. At length, however, McLaughlin fell one dark night as we hurried through the streets of a village, and we could not again raise him. "It's no use, Harris," I heard him say in a faint voice. "I can do no more." Next morning, when day broke, he was no longer seen in the ranks, and as I never saw him again, I conclude he quickly perished. Crawford seemed to sniff the sound of battle from afar with peculiar feelings. He halted us for a few minutes occasionally when the distant clamour became more distinct, and his face turned towards the sound and seemed to light up and become less stern. It was then indeed that every poor fellow clutched his weapon more firmly and wished for sight of the enemy. Before long, they had their wish. The enemy's cavalry were on our skirts that night, and as we rushed out of a small village, the name of which I cannot now recollect, we turned to bay. Behind broken down carts, huge trunks of trees, and everything we could scrape together, the rifles lay and blazed away at the advancing cavalry, whilst the inhabitants, suddenly aroused from their beds to behold their village almost on fire with our continued discharges, ran from their houses. The rain was pouring down in torrents on this morning, I recollect, and we remained many hours with our arms ready, standing in this manner, staring the French cavalry in the face, the water actually running out of the muzzles of our rifles. A man named Higgins was my front rank man at this moment. "Harris," said he, "let you and I gain the very top of this mountain and look out what those French thieves are doing at the other side." My feet were sore and bleeding, and the sinews of my legs ached as if they would burst, but I resolved to accompany him. But one or two of the videttes of the French cavalry were prowling around very near where we went. As we had received orders not to make more noise than we could help, not even to speak to each other, except in whispers, although one of these horsemen approached close to where I lay, I forbore to fire against him. At length, he stopped so near me that I saw it was almost impossible he could avoid discovering that the rifles were in such close proximity to his person. He gazed cautiously along the ridge, took off his helmet and wiped his face, when suddenly our eyes met. And in an instant he plucked a pistol from his holster, fired it in my face, and wheeling his horse, plunged down the hillside. For the moment, I thought I was hit, but the ball grazed my neck and stuck fast in my knapsack, where I found it when, many days afterwards, I unpacked my kit aboard ship. I remember the first occasion when I was called upon to go over the top. It was during the Somme Do, where our battalion had already been in some nasty business. I heard about the 3rd Company's experiences during my recovery from an overdose of rum, and I was new enough a soldier to feel the strain on my heartstrings when I realised that rum's stupor had saved me from participation. The date was July 27th, 1916. We were bivouacked in a valley near Flicourt, a place of vast mine craters in virgin chalk. I remember clambering about them, trying to stop my imagination from recreating the sensations of the troops who had once occupied trenches there. Lying about were bits of equipment, clothing, bodies. God, imagination was not needed. The thing was reconstructed before my eyes. I was in this frame of mind when we were told to be prepared to move into the line that night. I was a signaller. Most old soldiers will know what this implies. Bayonet drill, bombing practice, in short, all those exercises which were supposed to make an efficient soldier had been carefully and cunningly dodged. I began to regret this. Already I could see myself outclassed by some proficient German in a hand-to-hand encounter. To be sure, the blade of his bayonet would be sore cut. Good Lord, what a fool I had been. I wondered what it might feel like to be wounded, to be killed. All through that night, I never had a wink of sleep. In the morning, we were told that our affair had been postponed 24 hours. Our CO kept us from a sleep of exhaustion, which is so easy in the morning, by choosing that time for his heroic lecture to us, in whose hands lay his reputation. Slowly but surely, that day, the 28th, passed. Last night, we thought we were going over the top. Tonight, we know. Our CO himself told us so. Back come all the bogeys of the previous night. I find myself engaged in calculating the chances of escape. Surely a quarter of our number will remain unscathed. I have one chance in four of coming out none the worse. And so I tortured myself all through that second night. At times I would nod off to sleep. "It's all off, it's all off," something would say, and my whirling, maddening thoughts, becoming smoother, less insistent, more incoherent, would creep almost into the arms of sleep. "Fool, wake up. It's postponed 1 hour, 2 hours. That's all." I jump with a start. The whole mental anguish began all over again. We did not go up that night, but on the night of the 29th we actually started for the front line. Where we had been lying in bivouac, the noise of the guns had been an incessant thunder. We'd found time to pity the poor devils who were already in the thick of it. Now we found ourselves approaching the monster. Gradually, as we moved, we were enwrapped in that almost sea of sound, and shells burst nearer and nearer. Stumbling along in the inky darkness, the intensity of which was preserved by frequent explosions, I can hardly attempt to describe my thoughts and feelings. There came a time when two horses dashed madly past us towards the rear. They had been released from their load by a shell which had killed their driver and shattered their wagon. With a crash, one of them collapsed within a yard of us, showing horribly plainly that even horse flesh could not be disemboweled and live. We continued going forward. Then the darkness was temporarily relieved. A dump of veery lights had been exploded, and a firework display, enough to confuse the most carefully contrived artillery signals, shed a fantastic light upon this hell on earth. Darkness may be awful, but when duty tells you to go and be killed and, in the going, to walk past wounded men right and left in the eerie light of military fireworks, the horror of it becomes almost unbearable. Just before we arrived in our jumping-off trench, something happened which I can never forget. A young soldier of my own section was struck by a shell fragment square between the eyes. His cries haunt me now. "Mother of God, Mother of God," he shrieked time and time again. We left him behind where he lay, whimpering, "Mother of God, good God, I'm blind." It got in my ears. "Mother of God," I reiterated, scarcely knowing what I was saying. At last, we arrived at the front line. Zero was 7:15 a.m. In a few minutes, we would endure the supreme test. Furtive peeps over the parapet revealed nothing of the enemy trenches, for a mist lay over all. In me, strangely enough, this induced feelings of utter weariness, followed by spasms of fatalistic carelessness, which I could have wished to last the whole war through. But our emotions come and go like clouds in the sky, and my newfound peace of mind was short-lived. Suddenly, the noise of the guns eased off. For a second or two, there was quiet. Then, the fury of our barrage dropped like a wall of roaring sound before us. By some means, the signal to advance was given and understood, and we found ourselves walking forward in the mist, feeling utterly naked. Who can express the sensations of men brought up in trench warfare suddenly divested of every scrap of shelter? Forward we stumbled into a mist that seemed to grow ever thicker. So great was the noise that the order to keep in touch with one another was passed only by means of shouting our hardest, and our voices sounded like flutes in a vast orchestra of fiends. All at once, I became conscious of another sound, a noise like the crisp crackle of twigs and branches burning in a bonfire just beyond my vision in the mist, made me think I must be approaching some burning building. But I realized, when my neighbor on the right dropped with a bullet in the abdomen, that the noise was machine gun and rifle fire. Presently, we came to the first enemy trench, when we saw our artillery had done its work well and truly. We had to pass this trench, but there was almost no need to jump over it, for it was almost filled in, blown in. After scrambling over what remained of this trench, I found myself with another signaller, cut off completely from the rest by the mist. We had come close together in our scrambling and remained together. We were alone in a mist which we began to suspect was not altogether made by nature. Here was a fine mess. Friar, that was my companion's name, and myself cut off from our comrades, not knowing whither we were going, nor how far we should go. What should we do? We did what irresponsible private soldiers could do, dropped into the nearest shell hole. Discussing our position over a woodbine, we went to sleep. An hour later, I was nudged into wakefulness by Friar. It was considerably quieter, but bullets were still zipping past. The mist had cleared a little, and visibility was extended to about 400 or 500 yards. It was with real thankfulness that I found the captain of our company. He was sheltering in a shell hole, just as Friar and I had done. Messages had already gone out, we were told, ordering a general withdrawal to our starting point. The attack had failed. Pray God we should not have to do it all over again. I'm sorry, I cannot finish this short account of a push with some stirring deed of valor. Fritz soon became aware of our intention to abandon the attack, and it was not long before his artillery was blowing our trench to pieces. Friar was killed at my side. I cannot describe the incident. I saw about as much red as was left in the poor chap's face when he settled in a crouching posture, dead. From that time until we were relieved, I waited every second for a similar end. I was buried and got out. I trembled violently for 10 solid minutes with shell shock, but recovered and had to hang on. Our whole brigade had suffered very heavy losses. We were taken behind the lines for a rest, addressed by our GOC, told how, through lack of information, we had valiantly attacked a force 3 times our number, and, after being brought up to strength, we were sent in to do it again.